Almost 10 million tourists traveled through our islands last year. Our public infrastructure and services are struggling to keep up with the needs of the hundreds of thousands of tourists in Hawaii on any given day. The Honolulu City Council's Business, Economic Development, and Tourism Committee met yesterday to discuss the impacts of our growing visitor population on public safety. Councilmember Kimberly Pine, who chaired the meeting, wanted to know how the different districts were coping as more tourists wander further out of Waikiki. Major Diggins DeChito of the Honolulu Police Department explained the challenges that his department is facing in keeping tourists safe.
We also know that other areas are getting a lot more popular, especially those in the Kailua area. I worked in the Kaneohe Kailua district for over 3 years as a captain, and we saw a great number of tourists in that area too. And that district is the largest district that we have as far as square mile goes for in the entire department. It's 125 square miles, I believe. It covers pretty much the entire east coast of the island and has three different district stations. The staffing level for there does need an increase because you're talking about, you know, like I said, covering 124 square miles from Waimanalo all the way through Kahuku. So and on a given day, I had maybe five officers in the Kailua area, not only responding to calls for service, but to try to keep our tourists safe. Mm-hmm. So increased staffing in that area, especially if we had a dedicated group of officers just to concentrate in the Kailua Beach area, would probably greatly enhance the feeling of safety for our visitors.
The council committee also heard testimony from representatives of the Department of Emergency Medical Services, the Visitor Aloha Society of Hawaii, VASH, and the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Councilmember Kimberly Pine hopes to pass legislation to address the staffing needs of our first responders. In a media statement, Pine said this: "We need to understand and account for the public safety impact of our rapidly increasing visitor arrivals on Oahu. Our first responders are tasked with ensuring all of our residents and visitors are safe, so they must have the resources and the county policies necessary to take care of the community. The visitor industry is the foundation of our local economy, and tourists need to feel safe at our beaches, on our hiking trails, in our beautiful public spaces. However, more visitors mean more public safety issues with people who are unfamiliar with the dangers associated with visiting islands in the middle of the Pacific. We have to be sure the county provides what our first responders need," end quote. The Business, Economic Development, and Tourism Committee is scheduled to meet again on Tuesday, July 23rd at 10:30 a.m.
Hawaii Public Radio is looking for a community-minded business development professional to join our underwriting team as a corporate relations associate. If you're experienced in establishing new corporate support business, enriching existing relationships, and ensuring client satisfaction, we want to hear from you. A love for public radio is a plus. Read more about the position at hawaiipublicradio.org. Application deadline is June 30th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're going to the movies. Now, if you're of a certain age, you probably have fond or maybe not so fond memories of saving your hard-earned allowance to see your favorite star on the silver screen. Now, as the public's appetite for the glamour of the Hollywood blockbuster grew, island operators built venues to accommodate the swelling demand. By the mid-1930s, Hawaii was a hotbed of movie theaters with over two dozen neighborhood cinemas on Oahu and more on the neighbor islands. The ones that come to mind today are Kauai's Waimea Theater, Maui's historic Iao Theater, Hawaii Island's Palace Theater, and one of our favorites, the Queen Theater in Kaimuki. For today's quiz, can you tell us which theater is the oldest of the four we just listed? Did you miss the question? Here it is again. Which lady is the oldest? Hilo's Palace Theater, Wailuku's historic Iao Theater, Kaimuki's Queen Theater, or Kauai's Waimea Theater? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Stuart Scott from ClimateMatters.tv. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This week's reopening of Kohio Highway was met with a protest by residents. HBR's Ku'uwehi Hirishi here to talk about the tensions in the community on the Garden Isle. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So on Monday, this past Monday, Kohio Highway was reopened. And on that first day, not as many bumps in terms of protests. There was no protest on day one, but there were community members posted out along sides of the road, sitting in beach chairs, holding signs saying, slow down. You know, welcome to our neck of the woods. But a few sort of, bumps throughout the day had prompted them to, on Tuesday, go ahead and protest. So what happened in the protest Tuesday morning from media reports is about 20 protesters went ahead and locked arms and created a human chain along Kuhio Highway, turning away about 50 tourists, as far as we know, before the cops were, Kauai County Police was able to come to the scene and sort of disperse the human chain and have them sit on sides of the road so people can go through. They did allow construction workers through because there is construction still continuing on the bridges along Kuhio Highway as folks start to come back in. But the sentiment from some in the community that did decide to protest was, we're not ready. And there are a few things that, you know, the rules that are in place, they want folks to understand them if they don't have a permit. So right now, Haena State Park and access to it, which is pretty much the end of the road, so access to things like Ka Beach or the Napali Coast, Kalalau Trail, Hanakapi'i Falls, those are all available for tourists through a reservation system that also includes a parking reservation system. So those rules that are in place, I guess, are what the community is trying to educate everyone on as they go out there. And in that first day, I think they just felt like there wasn't as much outreach or education to the point where everyone knew what was going on. So I think DLNR spokesman Dan Dennison had said for every one car that had a permit, there were about four or five that didn't.
Oh,
and so they were turned away. And this is, state officials and county officials have been saying, you know, this is going to be a rough challenge for us to implement sort of a visitor limits and figuring out how to keep people from indulging in this side of town. But as to the protests, I got to speak to Joel Guy, who's the president of the Hanaleitu Haena Community Association and has kind of led the initiative, the Hanale Initiative, to create a shuttle system and help manage the relationship between the community and visitors as well. So this is what he had to say about the protests.
There's clearly people that are very agitated. I mean, it's been very scary. You put mental stretches on people where you put them in a convoy system for long periods of time, and then you open up to a general public. I, I definitely feel the frustration of people that are outside of the area that are like, hey, we pay our taxes and we should go in there. And you can definitely, it's a valid argument. I just hope that we can show some compassion for people also that are feeling the pressure of this huge influx of people. I mean, it's the first couple of days. I think this hopefully will all tend to simmer down and we can all work together to try and find some solutions.
That's right. So we should put that in context. The road has been closed for over a year, 14 months to be exact. And some in the community out at the end of the road, they have gotten used to not having a lot of visitors or residents or really any influx from the outside. And, you know, we heard reports of the fish coming back at Haena, community-based subsistence fishing area, and also the community just having room and freedom to live their lives as they did before the influx of tourism over on the coast. And so getting used to that and then having that reversed was, I think, an adjustment and will continue to be an adjustment. But like Guy was saying, there are still folks in the community out in Haena, Wainiha, who are still recovering either their homes, their cars, their jobs. But that convoy system was a relief that the convoy system had ended and that folks are able to freely move in and out. But that also comes with an influx of visitors, and that's what people are sort of trying to balance right now.
Right, and that over-tourism thing is such a sensitive issue.
Well, it is, and I think in smaller communities, especially like the north shore of Kauai, you're talking about, at least in the Wainiha and Haena area, it's talking about only about a little over 1,000 residents, really small community. And then you've got, from the numbers that Hawaii Tourism had given out, about 700,000, over 700,000 tourists a year coming to that coast. So that balance is I guess that not being in balance was something that as they reopened, everyone was very cognizant of, including Mayor Kawakami. So Derek Kawakami got to speak to him prior to the reopening about some of his lingering concerns over this reopening and what it means to that community. And this is what he had to say.
So that's one of the main concerns, is that people will see that it's reopened and forget that this community has gone through some tremendous hardship, an ongoing tremendous hardship. It's been over a year since they've been cut off from the rest of the world, and we just hope that people can be mindful and respectful of the rules that we're setting in place.
The word respect, I felt like I've heard that in pretty much every interview with folks over on Kauai, community members and state officials, but this idea that there are new rules in place, so visitor limits for Haena State Park is going from about 3,000 down to 900. But keep in mind that there are only 100 parking stalls at the park. So you've got 900 capacity, but also 100 actual physical capacity. So things like the shuttle systems that are being implemented were thought to be something that could help lessen
solution.
That impact.
A exactly. Good solution. I have to admit, when I first heard about the blockade, I was thinking, oh, shades of the super ferry.
Kauai, yes. Very much an active community and a very tight-knit community. And so when there are changes like this, I think everyone, it was positive. No one, you know, there was no arrests made. There was no sort of yelling or, you know, things along those lines. There were a few agitated tourists. Asu Kanoho, the head of the Kauai Island Visitors Bureau, had said once the word was getting out that they would start to limit access to that end of the coast, that there were tourists that had approached the Visitors Bureau saying, you know, well, I'm not going to come there anymore if this is what you guys, you know, what you guys are doing. And she, in a very tactful way, had said, you know, that's welcome. That's your opinion for those who might be open to what they're trying to do out on the coast and preserving that area for future generations. Just take a few extra, some extra time to prep, and hopefully you'll have a better experience. It's a new way, essentially, of experiencing Haena State Park. So I got to speak to Kurt Cottrell, head of Division of State Parks, and he says, you know, it's an experiment. It's something that we're really going to have to figure out, but it won't be perfect. This is what he had to say.
If we can pull it off at Haena, you know, we have other state park models that we could then maybe look at and try to, you know, do the same type of reduction. Because, I mean, our parks are really just getting loved to death, and we're so glad that people like to come and visit them, but none of our parks were ever designed or envisioned for this type of tourist number. It's an experiment. I anticipate we will fail in some elements, and we'll have to use adaptive management to reboot and reset, and then, you know, reconfigure, you know, how we're going to do all this. But all the pieces, we set the table. Now we'll just see if we can, you know, have everybody come eat politely.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yes.
But that, you know, it really is only day three. Things are going to, it's going to take some adapting, like he said, both on the counties and also a state and the community. I think we'll see how this all rolls out over the next couple of weeks. We're looking forward to another shuttle coming online on Friday, so hopefully that will help with ease the congestion.
Have you heard anything from DOT? I know they were saying that, yeah, you know, they've had to open it up because of the safety issues were addressed.
Oh, yeah. No, I did not hear. I don't think there was any concern over whether it was safety issues, but it was the idea that you are still letting 900 folks in, but only 100 parking stalls. So it's figuring out what to do about that, I think, is going to be the biggest issue.
Right. And I know here on Oahu, we've had the Pali closed, right, for a while. So we'll be curious to see what happens in August.
Exactly.
I know I was hearing from Kailua friends that, yeah, they were glad that the number of people coming to Kailua has backed off a bit. So, interesting issues to follow.
Exactly. Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Well, we've been talking with HPR's Ku'uwe Hiraishi about what lies ahead for Kauai with this week's opening of Kuhio Highway following last year's flood.
Hi, this is Jose Fajardo, President and General Manager at Hawaii Public Radio. If HPR is a part of your daily routine, isn't it time to make a commitment and become a member of the station? New members are so important to helping HPR grow and give you more of the programs that you already know and love. So why not take 2 minutes and become a member today at $10 a month or any amount that works for you? Just go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Each new member really does help, and thanks.
New developments in the struggle over water rights on Maui. That's the subject of today's Reality Check. Honolulu Civil Beat's politics and opinion editor Chad Blair on the line this morning. Hi there.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what happened?
Well, without going into too much complexity, because it is a complex and lengthy issue, what happened was the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the ICA in Hawaii, yesterday issued an opinion. And it pertains specifically to this lawsuit called Carmichael versus BLNR, the Land Board, and A&B. That's Alexander and Baldwin. And in a nutshell, the ICA has asked a lower court, the First Circuit Court, to take a look at this case again to resolve a couple of factual issues regarding these water lease permits that the state has been granting to A&B in East Maui. And also suggested that, you know, maybe the state's environmental laws don't actually apply to this particular case. I'm talking specifically about Chapter 343. That's our very important law on having environmental assessments and environmental impact statements done on pretty complicated, important projects impacting the environment.
I understand that the governor tweeted about this development.
Well, he actually tweeted the day before, and it was an interesting bit of timing because the governor was in his tweet saying, look, we're working to resolve this water rights issue. And I know at least one or two sources who looked at that and said, I wonder if he had a heads up about
yes.
the ICA decision. I don't know that the governor did, and I can tell you that the administration referred all inquiries to the Department of Land and Natural Resources, which issues the permits, and the Attorney General's office. I can tell you that the Land Board and the AG's office looked pretty happy with the decision. They felt like it affirmed their authority, particularly the Land Board, the DLNR, to issue these water permits. Suzanne Case, the chair of the Land Board, said she looked forward to working on this. Having said that, there was criticism from the people representing Carmichael, the other plaintiffs as well. That's the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. They said the ICA basically punted on the decision there, that they failed to resolve this case, which now is going on 18 years and counting and really dates back, you know, to the 19th century when sugarcane and was being farmed in Maui. They also said that eventually, look, this is probably going to have to go to the Hawaii Supreme Court. What do you mean Chapter 343 doesn't apply? That's a fundamental law when you're talking about land and water. So it still remains contentious.
Right. But I think, you know, this was a really big win for the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation, you know, as we were going through the process, right? So I imagine, yeah, they're not too happy. But the effective result of this decision, though, this ruling, gives them more breathing time, I guess.
It certainly gives the state more time. Suzanne Case indicated, and others said as well, that means the water's not going to be turned off at the end of 2019 when these permits expire. And it looks like the land board has the authority, or the DLNR has the authority, to continue issuing these one-year revocable permits to use this water. In A&B's case, they're diverting stream water from East Maui and sending it down to the Central Plain there. You might recall A&B sold all its land, or a good chunk of its land, I think all of it, to Mahi Pono, which is working to develop diversified agriculture, and they need the water. It's very dry there in Central Maui.
Right. And, you know, we should also underscore that the whole, I guess, the landscape has changed because the last sugar mill closed down. And so this is just a way to deal with the aftermath of that, right? Because water was the big, I should say sugar was the big water sucker.
Yeah. But if diversified ag is going to prosper, and that's something that a lot of people have talked about, not just in the agricultural community, they're going to need water as well. And as part of that deal, A&B selling that land to Mahi Pono, the Sierra Club said there was a deal to make sure that water keeps going there. A&B, by the way, said, no, that's a red herring. You don't quite have that argument right. But bottom line, A&B does want to continue with these water permits based on their application process with the DLNR.
And there's no timeline then for the lower court to look at this, is there?
No, and that's a good question, too. How long is this going to take? It is interesting. The ICA had been sitting on this appeal for 3 years since the First Circuit Court won. And then suddenly, in a flurry, they make the decision. No timeline, though, the courts can take as they choose to take.
Okay, be interesting, yeah, to see how this plays out and when it actually gets resolved.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Thanks so much. That was politics and opinion editor Chad Blair. He's with Honolulu Civil Beat. He was giving us today's reality check and the latest in the water struggle on Maui. To read his story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. June 20th, which is tomorrow, marks the 100th birthday of someone who some regard as Hawaii's First Lady of Limu. Isabella Kawakea Abbott is the first Native Hawaiian woman to earn a Ph.D. in science. She became the leading expert on Pacific marine algae. One of her students, Professor Celia Chun, who is also a co-director of the Marine Biology Graduate Program at the University of Hawaii, joined us in studio this morning. She's working to perpetuate Abbott's legacy, a woman that she says worked 6 days a week for 60 years.
Over the period where she taught ethnobotany at Manoa, she had said she had about 1,000 undergrads, and I think I've met many of them. People hear that you worked with Dr. Abbott, and they come forward with wonderful stories of how she made a difference in their life or impacted them in some way. That was a class that was standing room only for about 15 or more years. So this is an opportunity for the community to come forward and help celebrate this remarkable Hawaiian scientist.
So come share your stories about the Lady of Limu.
That's right, absolutely.
And you love Limu. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't be working in it, right?
Well, Izzy was really one of the people who got me hooked on it. And so I am a direct descendant in that way of the love that she had for them. Sure, her interest came from her mother, she and her brother to the beach as young kids. That's so important for so many of our children to actually experience the natural world around them and get interested in some aspect, and who knows what will happen. You might end up with a career that could allow you to teach and get other students interested in seaweeds or native algae or even some of our endemics or our limu. There's so much that we have as opportunities here in the Hawaiian Islands. It's kind of remarkable still.
Well, now, talk about the collection that we have at Bishop Museum, because it's pretty stellar.
It's fabulous, and yet really underappreciated for the science that it contains, as well as the traditions that scientists, especially botanists, have for recording the collections, plants that have been collected from all over the world. But in particular, here in the Hawaiian Islands, when Dr. Abbott retired, about two-thirds of her herbarium actually was moved from botany at Manoa to the Bishop Museum. So many of her really critical specimens, and by critical I mean the alga on which she placed a new genus or a new species name, are actually deposited at Bishop Museum and held under very tight control. These are following the standards for science. We have to have that kind of measure in order to protect them. That's important because it allows other scientists in the future to come back and study those particular specimens. It's a very kind of structured type of science that's done in this area. But those collections are absolutely foundational to so much of what is done here.
Right. There's a protocol. And the specimens they have there are great, because I had the opportunity to be able to see some of them, some of the plants that Captain Cook collected from his third voyage, I think. And I thought, that's awesome.
Fabulous. Our collections for algae only started about maybe 1850, and really in some significance about 1950. And so there aren't probably as many in the algal side as there are in the Captain Cook terrestrial side, but still the ones we have are spectacular. When Dr. Abbott was still with us, she would bring some of those specimens to my classroom so that I could show students. With her departure, sadly, we've lost that opportunity. So part of what I've asked as part of this special occasion celebrating her science is actually to bring some of those really remarkable specimens back out from their very protective cabinets in order for people the public to see them.
Oh, so what are you going to share?
We have about 10 or 12 that I'm going to talk about after we go through some of the earlier events that are planned for this birthday party. But some of them are the genera that she's named that haven't been found elsewhere in the world. Some of them are plants that came from the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands when it was still the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And Izzy was maneuvering to try and get attention drawn to this very special part of our archipelago. So she took a beautiful plant that Carla McDermott had collected from Midway and named it after Secretary of the Interior Babbitt.
Really?
And then sent him a copy of that specimen. This is what Akamai scientists, right? Using
Brilliant.
Her science and her culture in a way that really marks her as unusual, maybe outstanding in terms of having foot in both of those worlds, science and culture.
Right, but that's a dilemma, right? I mean, it's how do you get people to care? Oh, you care passionately about the limu that's out there that's growing at Diamond Head and Eva and, mm-hmm. you know, on Kauai and off the Big Island. But the folks that actually then maybe fund projects that we need to fund,
That's an ongoing challenge, but I think it's getting easier and easier as we raise the awareness for the vital role that these plants play. They are the basis for the foundation for all the marine ecosystems and coastal environments, including the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And so Dr. Abbott was a pivotal person in identifying the major collections that came out of the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, from the lobster traps, all of that work that was done from the 1970s through the 80s, funded by NOAA Research, gave us a flora up there. We can talk about the energy flow into those ecosystems. It provides a basis for us to begin to understand how climate change might impact that area from the plant point of view. It gives us a chance to recognize just how unusual and how important it is to conserve that area, because the native species dominate. There's only been, I believe, one actual find of an invasive up there. We battle with invasives constantly on these main Hawaiian Islands, and it's an ongoing effort, some of which we still don't have a kind of tool set that actually will help us solve the problems.
Well, I mean, we're talking about basic science, and it's identifying what's out there in our marine world. And I know when I go out, you know, snorkeling or swimming, and I see something, you know, on the reef, and I'm like, oh, what is that? It looks like snot. You know, like someone just sneezed underwater. And he's like, is that curiosity? He's like, what is that? What am I looking at?
Well, and that's what marks the Hawaiian traditions of being such keen observers of the world that they lived in. And so many of the things that Dr. Abbott inherited from her mother was that love, that curiosity, but also the naming scheme. The Hawaiians recognized things when they were the same. They recognized them when they were different. They knew which fish ate what alga. They named things after each other. There's a limu maneoneo and there's a fish maneoneo. And that's not by accident. They are intimately related in terms of probably their diet. And so from the Hawaiian culture, we can see these connections. She took that kind of cultural awareness in terms of the native natural world around her and the native species and brought science to it. And so in that way, we have a better appreciation, a deeper connection to those islands. And I'm hoping that these connections will eventually reverberate so that we can solve some of these larger issues with dealing with invasive species.
Now, you know, the work that you folks are doing at the University of Hawaii is really groundbreaking. I mean, whether you're going down in an undersea submarine and getting video of these unusual sea creatures in the deep depths to what you're doing, identifying just some of the basic stuff that's out there.
Right. Actually, Dr. Abbott was the one who did the identification, and so I need to call that out because her work first in California for the 30 years she worked at Stanford's Marine Station, that Marine Algae California publication from 1976 laid the foundation for decades of kelp forest and intertidal ecology to be done by others who had the name already worked out. These are some of the most cited publications probably in the marine literature for the mainland U.S. because she laid the foundation of what its name is. When she finished kind of cleaning up California, which the flora actually extends from Alaska to Baja California, so it's really the West Coast, there is nobody else who has been able to bring modern up-to-date work to update her marine algae of California. So that's we're not the only ones where the marine plant community may not be getting as much attention. However, Izzy collected her bags, moved home finally when she retired with Don. The two of them moved back, and she started a project to give us that same level of information. So with colleagues, a number of them from across the Pacific, in 1999, she published the Marine Red Algae of the Hawaiian Islands, which is the documents, that book is still the standard for identification.
And we're going to be republishing that book, right? Or
this
is her collections?
We'll be seeing some of her collections that she used, and including, I hope, the alga that's on the cover of that book, one of the genera that she described. She, in 2004, I believe, published the Marine Greens and Browns, a whole nother volume. These were funded in part with Packard Foundation funding, printed through the Bishop Museum. They together give us the information base to allow us to have the best understanding of the names for all of our nearly 600 species of algae.
And we have
in the Pacific, right? There's just in the tropical Pacific, there's no other place that has the turf algae or the frondose algae as well studied as we have.
And there's still flora out there that we haven't properly
identified. Absolutely. If you go a little bit deeper into our mesophotic flora, we're realizing that that's a whole nother community of plants. Allison Sherwood is leading a project now that will hopefully close that gap. But right now, we don't know, we don't have names for about 40% of what has come in through the Hurl collections.
That's amazing.
So this is a vital, dynamic time in marine botany, the opportunity to study these algae, and Izzy laid the foundation for it that gave us the traditions to continue. We can now ask questions about impacts of invasive species because we know what's an invasive and what's not.
And you mentioned you didn't like the term seaweed. Limu.
Yeah, limu or natives. Not the seaweeds. I'm reserving that special term for our invasives because they are the weeds, right? We don't need to give them that status of being a limu, please. And so if you are uncertain, there's lots of information, or come to one of our cleanups in the Waikiki Aquarium where we share lots of that kind of content. Izzy offers a model for those people who don't think that we can close the gap between science and culture. And so this is a tremendous opportunity to join the community people who want to celebrate her birthday and see how it was done. Imagine navigating a career in science when you got your PhD from Berkeley in 1950. I mean, that's the era of Joe McCarthy. That's an era where you didn't get ahead unless you looked like him, right? And so she was able to navigate the unknown in a way that is very timely for us now in some ways, with the challenges that we face for climate change as an unknown, for the impacts of urbanization as an unknown, for the threat of invasive species as unknowns, but also in the political climate as unknowns. How are we going to survive as islanders living under a variety of threats? Right? She gave us a model with grace and humor to keep one foot in both camps, her culture, and to be a leader in science. Over 200 papers published, 9 workshops, 8 books, a tradition of discipline and yet following her curiosity.
Now, I don't know if she had a favorite limu, but do you?
She told me once that she thought Limu'kala was the most important. And that's in part because of its sacred role in the Ho'oponopono ceremony to trigger a kind of reconciliation among family where there might be some discord. No other people have put in a seaweed or a limu at that level in their family structure. And so that's, I think, a pretty important one. I like limu'kohu.
Why?
Spicy flavor.
Okay, you can have some for lunch.
Let's go get some poke. Limu poke.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Catherine.
That was botanist Celia Smith of the Limu Lab sharing stories about her mentor, Isabella Abbott. The work of the native Hawaiian Hana-born Lady of Limu will be showcased at a talk at Bishop Museum Thursday night. The special event runs from 6 to 7:30 at the Atherton Halau. They would like people to register. So if you want to attend and for links for more information about this event, head to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering more than 170 flights a day between the neighbor islands. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
Saturday, June 29th in HPR's Atherton Studio. Expect a gumbo of musical genres from Tuality, offering a blend of blues, rock, Americana, and folk. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Note to self, little tip for you and nobody else. Don't be surprised.
Earlier in the show, we reminisced about local movie theaters. Depending on when you grew up, it's very likely you'd seen the price of a ticket go way up. And movie genres have grown up a lot, too. Now, back in the early 20th century, there were no movie-on-demand streaming services like Netflix. And when a new title hit the box office, movie buffs braved long lines to be the first ones to see it on the silver screen. Popular culture spurred demand, so local entrepreneurs built neighborhood cinemas throughout the state. And early in the show, we highlighted 4 theaters that are still around today. We tested your architectural history and asked you to identify the oldest of the bunch. Did you know that Maui's historic E.L. Theater, built in the Spanish Mission style, opened in 1928 and once was the main entertainment venue for Wailuku? Kauai's Waimea Theater first welcomed audiences in 1938, and its electric marquee was the first of its kind for the Garden Isle until Hurricane Iniki destroyed it in 1992. And Honolulu's Queen Theater started in 1936. It was a popular fixture on Wailai Avenue. Low admission prices started at just 10 cents, a dime. And drumroll please, the Grand Dame of the bunch resides on the Big Island, designed by architects Davis and Fishborn in the Beaux-Arts style. Hilo's Palace Theater was built in 1925. Now, over 9 decades later, it is still a popular entertainment venue for island audiences. And congratulations to Fred of Kalihi. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you were lucky enough to attend last month's Hula Imua show at the Hawaii Theater this spring, well, you caught a teaser of a new artistic work, a hula musical. Kumuhulu Patrick Makuakane of Nale Huluikveikiu, based in San Francisco, is part of the endeavor. Take a listen to this song, written by Rosalind Katrakia and performed by Jana Angwe Alkane.
Why can't they understand? I'd be so proud. Hi'iaka come, hi'iaka now. Hi'iaka, you've got this, you know how. I wanna know what makes me different than the rest. Can't they see I need to be my best? But still, I drift like the scent of hala moaniana. To know all there is to know. Kuleana, koku kuleana. One day I will find you, leave my useless days behind to live my kuleana. Koku kuleana. I'm not a little girl anymore. Time to learn what my life is for.
Kuleana. We invited choreographer Patrick Makuakane to swing by Hawaii Public Radio to talk about what he's hatching.
So this is a new venture that they've been working on actually before I came on board, several years. It was just Kili Raichel and Roz Katrakia, who is an incredible music teacher at Punahou, and Kili Raichel, well, he needs no damn introduction. So they've been working on for several years, and I came on board as a choreographer. And after speaking with each other about the story of Hi'iaka and Pele, I was included as one of the authors. So the three of us are writing the book. And basically, Roz is doing the more, for lack of a better term, Broadway musical kinds of songs, and Kili'i is doing the Hawaiian. And I'm sort of, since I have feet in both worlds, I guess I'm helping out with, not really helping out, but adding my two cents whether they like it or not.
Okay.
And I'm the choreographer. But Kili and I are offering these sort of more cultural feedback, and Roz is an amazing writer. Boy, she can turn out a song like that song you saw on the show called Kuleana was prompted by a discussion that Kili and I were having about Kuleana, what it means, and maybe, you know, going to a higher level of what Kuleana could be for certain people, because we think of it as, you know, what do you say, responsibility, right? It's your Kuleana to do this, it's your Kuleana to that, but, you know, it's much more intense than that. Is there a purpose? Some people have a purpose with their Kuleana. Well, we all do, but others are more clearly defined, you know. So just exploring that through a conversation, Roz took a lot of great notes, and the next day, boom, there was a song. It's like, wow.
It's an awesome song.
Oh, mahalo, yeah. And the woman who sings it, Jana, is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think folks in the audience that night were just like, wow, this is the start of something big.
Yeah, well, maybe. We hope so. You know, we'll see.
And so what's the time frame?
That's a good question. Right? Because it was supposed to be done like several years ago, but I think we got a little sidetracked because we are actually turning it into a shorter musical for Princess Cruise Lines, and that will be next year. And then after that is launched, we will be working on the two-act play. So, and we're not sure exactly where it's going to go. Hawaii for a little bit, we'd like to do that, and maybe Japan, maybe Vegas, and New York, that's a possibility as well. All the people who are involved in it have Broadway, so to speak, credentials. So, but that's not our end goal. You know, we're going to just take it slowly. Not slowly. We need to rush.
Okay. But, hurry up, huh?
Yeah, hurry up, because it's been going on for a while. So as soon as the one-act play is finished for Princess, then we're back on track and trying to turn it into a... It's a big story. It's a sprawling epic. There's a lot to... play with in this particular mo'olelo.
Well, I can see how you could kind of roll it out on a cruise, you know, just to try on the dress, right?
That's sort of exactly what we're doing. And Princess, what's great about Princess Cruise Line is they want an authentic story. And so that's kind of what we're doing, is just kind of trying it on and seeing how it works and what works, what didn't, you know, what we have to improve upon, and, you know, where we're going to go from there. And it's only a one-act play on Princess, but when it's finished, we work on a two-act play. And it's really challenging, you know, trying to keep it as authentic as possible. But when you have other producers and people who are reading the stories, they ask certain questions that you never pondered as someone who lives here. Why can Pele like leave in a dream state, but she can't bring Lohiau back with her? We don't understand. It's like,
yeah, she's supposed to be really powerful, right?
Well, she is really powerful. We know that, right? But to an audience who does not know anything about Pele, you know, how do you explain that? So we go back to the drawing boards. Kelly and I figure out, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And there are many, many versions of that particular mo'olelo. And one of the main ones that we're referencing is the one that came out by Ho'olu Mahiehie, which was put out by Awaya'ulu Puakea folks, because it's incredibly, it's epic. Right, and there's a translation, and there's the Hawaiian. So much of the Hawaiian for the chanting, as well as for the oli and the mele hula, it's coming from that particular mo'olelo. But as I mentioned, there are many, many other versions of this story. So
you got to try to find the right.
Right. A friend of mine offered me the best advice, and what he said was, great, now this gets to be your version. Like, okay, I like that. Yeah,
okay.
We'll see.
Pressure's off.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, not really, but yeah.
Well, now, it was funny because, like, the work that you do, I mean, when I saw the show and I saw your work for the first time, I was like, wow, this is really cutting edge. This is really taking hula to another level. And somebody I know who was there that night said, I don't know. This is not the hula that I know and I'm comfortable with. And I didn't say he didn't like it, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the hula that he knows it. No, it's not the hula that my grandmother knows. It's not the hula that my kuu knows, right? Because as generations go, move from generation to generation, hula is a way where we are not only preserving history, and we have a very strong traditional repertoire. I mean, I will, Wuniki with Mei Kamamalu Klein, and had a kihei, I received my kihei from Robert Casimiro as well, and I am in the process of undergoing an uniki with several of my dancers, I mean, about 30 of them, who have been with me for a long time. So all the chants and dances that we're studying for that particular repertoire are all traditional. Nothing has changed. I passed it on to them the way it was taught to me, and that's how it will be. The law is set down. I like laws. I like templates. I love to follow them. But then there's another area here where there really isn't any expression. As you move from decade to decade and century to century, is the result of what you're experiencing at the moment, right? And the other thing, when you think about our people and the hula that we consider traditional, there is a plethora of dances that represent tradition, right? Dances with pebbles and sticks and spit bamboos and dances standing up, sitting down for this chief, for that chief, for a variety of animals with puppets. I mean, it is extensive. This is, was not a culture who held hula in a box. It was very expansive. It was portraying their experience. Well, guess what? Today we live in an entirely different world, in a world that our ancestors, our kupuna, could never, ever imagine. So we get to have that choice as a kumu or an artist. Do we use everything that's available to us today and create work? Or do we just stay in a particular place and create work using those tools that our kupuna had? You know, I prefer to, like, give myself a wide berth. And fortunately for me, the biggest, I'm very fortunate in that both of my kumus really love what I do and have supported me for a very long time. So since they have my back, I'm just doing what feels right in my na'au.
Well, it was fun to be able to see your show because it was right before the Merry Monarch Hula Festival. And then I happened to watch the Kahiko on TV with the hula halau. And it was fascinating just to see it through their eyes.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, even with halau and Merry Monarch, even they're experimenting, right? Today, we just break down hula into two broad categories, hula kahiko, traditional hula, and hula awana, when we use that, when we call it contemporary hula. Although awana itself does not mean contemporary, it means to wander and drift. From what? From the traditional rituals and protocols associated with hula. So, and hula kahiko, hula that is traditional or old, but what if you're dancing to a chant that was just composed 10 years ago and you're using movement vocabulary that wouldn't be considered? So nomenclature is, I think, is something that we're still struggling with. But like our kupuna, they didn't struggle with it because if that was a hula uli uli, that's what they called it. Hula ohelo or hula ki'i. I mean, they had names for everything. So they knew exactly what category it belonged to.
So you just finished your show and you're working, you're dabbling with this Broadway musical. what are you going to do next year?
Well, next year, I was, you know, people for whatever reason really responded to this particular show. And so you always think, okay, great. So what's going on for next year? What am I going to do next year? Yeah, actually, something really cool. But I'm not ready to announce it yet. But something that I would be proud to have followed this show. So,
no
yeah.
hints?
Yeah. Let me see. Well, what hint can I give? It's going to feature some really extraordinary entertainers. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you did do a nice nod to Swing.
Well, yeah. Well, Kahula Nui, isn't it? They're extraordinary. I love their work. I mean, I think all of the singers in our show are really awesome. I mean, we had those two women from San Francisco who are incredible artists in their own right. And then, of course, you heard the two women singing for the Hiaka. And those guys who came out with that viral video at P.E. Mai. I mean, really wonderful artists. And so next year will be pretty grand as well.
Okay, and then maybe we'll see a couple more numbers from the Broadway musical?
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe.
Well, Patrick Mukwokani, thank you so
Mahalo
much.
Mahalo for inviting me. Ahui ho.
That was Patrick Mukwokani, who dropped by our studios to talk about a musical he's working on with local artists Kaylee Rochelle and Rosalind Katrakia. It tells the story of Hiiaka, the sister of Hawaii's fire goddess Pele. That's it for today. Tomorrow, sailor Mary Crowley talks to us about her latest ocean trek with the Ocean Voyages Institute's removing 35 tons of plastic. Tell us what you think, suggest a story idea, call or talk back line, and leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all the past ones available on The Conversation page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.